Sargent Irrigation Inc. versus Pohlmeier. Charles Sargent Irrigation Inc. versus Pohlmeier.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Bob Krieger. I represent the appellant on the oral argument in this case. Sargent filed suit against the appellant for services related to some well drilling on her property. She filed an answer denying liability and filed a counterclaim. This case is new to me. I had about 8 hours. But I can tell you that it's at least procedurally complicated as you read the briefs, and I'm not sure that it resolves itself nicely, but I'll give it a go. Nothing was resolved on the merits, but on March 10th of 2016, the court entered an order of sanctions against the appellant, granting a default judgment in favor of Sargent and against the appellant for discovery violations. That's clear. What's not clear is why the parties assumed that was some sort of a final order that resulted in executions on the judgment, a sheriff's sale on the property, and meanderings all the way into October of the next year. I think understanding the procedural history is important because I got to figure out what issues are properly before this court, and that's not an easy task either. But let me do it this way. As best I can figure, what actually happened on March 10th finds its way through the entire case into the final order in this court by a very long and circuitous route that is just complicated by all the stuff that happened in between based upon the execution on the judgment. The briefs talk about the order of April 10th, and there is some confusion about which order the appellant is actually opining on. But in the end, what happens is on January 12th, there is a motion which I consider to be in the form of a motion for new trial that touches back on the January 5th order, in which the court not only didn't set aside the default in December, but added a new sanction by striking the counterclaim, which is itself I don't know where it comes from. There wasn't a motion to strike it. There wasn't a dismissal of it. It was a strike. Is it without prejudice?
Wasn't it raised as an issue in the motion to vacate the default judgment?
I think, as I understand it, the first motion was arguing that they didn't get notice and she had a defense, and reaching back to the March 10th order. That's all of the machinations about the sale, motions objecting to the confirmation of the sale, all that stuff produced an order in January 5th that tied all of this together, in which the court said, well, I'm not vacating the March 10th order. I'm entering a new one on January 5th that is essentially a dispositive order. That is, I'm granting a default judgment in favor of the plaintiff and striking the counterclaim, whatever that means. Without prejudice, I'm not sure what that means. But in any event, counsel files on January 12th this motion that says, hey, wait a minute, something isn't right here. And we don't think you should have granted the default judgment on the 10th. You certainly shouldn't have reimposed it on the 5th and added this other sanction. There was no motion for modification of that order. So the brief spends a lot of time talking about the authority of the court to modify the order. I don't think that's right either. I don't think this is about authority to modify the order.
They can modify it because the motion was brought before the end of term, even though the hearing was after.
But no, okay. We filed the motion, but that's a...
Or there wasn't even a final order, arguably,
right
at that point.
And so I think the final order, then, the time to appeal, the whole question of the default extends through January 5th, told by the January 12th motion, until it's finally ruled on in October, that I guess the sale was not valid because all of the orders were not final, and that whole thing unraveled, and we were left basically with the sanction. So a long circuitous route comes down to what I think is the only issue before this court. Was there a discovery order in the case that supported the sanction of the summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff? Now, when I read the briefs, Sargent spends a lot of time talking about the need for a motion to compel, and I get that, but that's not what the complaint seems to be. What is summarized and restated?
That's our line.
Thank you. Can we use that?
I've heard it a lot, mostly in my case. It's a motion to extend the time to answer discovery that's granted an order directing discovery. And I don't find any authority anywhere that answers that question. I don't think it's a valid argument to say, if it was argued in the brief, it's not a correct argument, that you need a motion to compel. I think Sargent is correct, that the way the rules are written, they're self-executing. If you were told by the court to do something, discovery, whether it's in a formal, all the cases that are cited talk about subpoenas, and you were told, and there was it's something that the court said you had to do.
Well, that's under subsection B, right? Under, how about D, though? Subsection D addresses a party's failure to either answer the interrogatories or attend their own deposition. There's no order to compel that's required under that statute.
I don't. Or under that. I guess what the question I'm asking is narrower than that. I don't know the answer. Could be right. Could be wrong. If I'm right, the whole default process just unravels. If you don't do anything, if you just don't answer interrogatories, right? Nobody seeks a motion to compel, right? Nobody, but that's contrary to the practice rules. You're supposed to cajole people, talk to them before you file a motion. You're supposed to do a lot of things to get the discovery result, right? There's no evidence of any of that. What there is evidence of a motion for default based upon the failure to comply with the order. There is no order that we can find, and there is no effort that we can see up to March 10th to get the parties to comply with requests. And so the question is, can you go from just not answering interrogatories in a timely fashion to a motion for default judgment without anything intervening? And that's really what seems to have happened here, because the record behind the scenes is very cluttered as to lawyers were changing and was notice given and what happened on the 10th, and there's a lot more evidence about what happened in the later hearings. I think there's evidence, tape recordings, they try to provide evidence during these hearings trying to set aside that original default, but it gets lost in the discussion, and what comes out of the case at the end is simply a default judgment based upon whatever happened back in March. That is, whatever had gone on in March is the date that fixes the court's determination that her claim, Sargent's claim, was granted judgment. That never changes. What happens is her case gets stricken, and it becomes a final order in October of 2017. So if what's left is the question under either subsection, whether just not filing discovery and asking for an extension of time is an order, I think that's what Sargent is arguing, or create circumstances under which it's within the court's discretion to go right to a default judgment.
Well, when I look at subsection D, though, of Rule 37, failure of a party to attend its own deposition or serve answers to interrogatories or respond to requests for inspection. If a party fails to serve answers to interrogatories, the court in which this action is pending on motion, and there was a motion for sanctions,
right,
may make such orders in regard to the failure as are just and may include any of those things that are coming under the motion to compel that you're talking about, which includes a default judgment.
Yes, but when you read the cases or live the trial court life, there is a difference between the sanction following an order,
which comes under subsection B,
right, in which you don't abide by the order, and the ultimate sanction of a dismissal of your claim or a ruling on the merits. When you slide to the other subsection, where it's just a matter of you didn't do it, is the sanction of a dismissal with no other intervening orders or causes the right remedy, or is it an abuse of discretion? And so either way,
I don't read the appellant's brief ever raising the argument of this was too harsh. I read it as they make the argument that the court shouldn't have, that the court should not have done the prejudgment interest, so they're trying to reduce the amount of it, and they're trying to get it set aside because she didn't have all the proper notice that she claims she didn't receive. But I just don't read the argument as it was too harsh. It was they can't do it, which I agree, if you're under subsection B, the court can't do it. But I think the court can do it under D.
I'm out of time, but obviously the discretion component, there is a discussion in the propositions of law of what the standards are for grant. It's an extreme remedy. It's disfavored. So I can't find any case where simply you go right from not answering your interrogatories to a default judgment. And if that's the rule, please publish the opinion. I am out of time. Thank you very much.
How much did we take over the appellant? 10?
39.
39. Would you add 39 seconds to the appellant, if you so desire that?
Thank you. Hey, police court, I'm Charles Campbell. I represent the appellee, Sergeant Irrigation. Disappointed all the students left before our case started. Maybe that says something about our case. We are here because for more than a year and a half, Ms. Pohlmeier refused to comply with the court order and Nebraska court rules of procedure and provide discovery responses.
So I'm going to stop you right there, because when we look at this case, are we looking at what had happened? I have to look at my timeline. What happened at the time in March of 2016 when the default was entered? Or do we get to look at everything else that happened until 2017 and go, and she still hasn't answered that?
Right. And I think that that's a good question. The court's order for sanctions has to be looked at in the context of the proceedings that occurred over the entire time period that this case was pending. And I think it's important to note that this case drug on because Ms. Pohlmeier continued to challenge the court orders and allowed the case to remain active. And yet, in spite of that, throughout this time, she refused to provide discovery as ordered by the court and as required by the court rules. And in fact, she challenged that initial order for sanctions, which resulted in the entry of a default judgment in March of 16, by filing a motion to vacate. That continued the case until the court entered a further judgment on January 5 of 2017 and, in effect, replaced that original order, because the judge recognized it wasn't a final order, didn't dispose of all the claims. So she now entered a judgment that did dispose of all the claims and would have been a final judgment. And yet, in spite of that, which was nearly a year after she was ordered to provide discovery, she still didn't provide discovery.
Except that motion to vacate was still pending, right, on January of 2017? Court never ruled on that yet.
That's what the court ruled on, was that her motion to vacate on January 5 of 2017. Yes.
Didn't that decision come later in the year?
Did that come in October of 2017?
Well, that came upon a subsequent motion that she filed, a motion to alter or amend that January 5, 2017 order.
Because there had been no ruling on the motion to vacate. That was the basis, I believe, of the motion to alter or amend.
Well, and maybe I'm incorrect, but I understood the motion to alter or amend to be a challenge to the January 5 judgment. And she was challenging that January 5 judgment on a number of grounds. One, that it was entered out of term. Two, she continued to raise the same argument she raised in the motion to vacate. The lack of notice, the interest, the challenge to the confirmation, all those things. So I've understood that she filed a further motion to challenge that January 5 ruling, and that then was ruled on October 26 of 2017. So that's why I think it's important to consider the entire context of this case, which she kept alive through these motions that she filed. And what she should have done was simply filed a motion to vacate at some point and said, here are my discovery responses.
She did file a motion to vacate, though.
and attached discovery responses and said, this is the basis for my motion to vacate. She never did that. She never sought to comply with the court order, the rules of discovery, and provide discovery responses.
But to follow up on something Mr. Krieger said.
Yes.
The affidavit indicated that the interrogatories were served on December 4th of 15. Her attorney withdrew in January of 2016, and by the next month, you were requesting sanctions.
Yes.
What's the specific order that she was in violation of at that point? As Mr. Krieger indicated, the court granted her an extension of time to do her or finalize her discovery.
Yes, and what that is an order to provide discovery.
To extending time is the same thing as ordering, compelling, because of failure to comply previously? I mean, if you're granting an extension of time and then
yes.
a person doesn't comply with that, then you would file a request to find them, you know, in noncompliance, and then there could be an order. But there doesn't seem to have been an order here demanding compliance by that date or else.
There was not an order to compel. You're correct. There was an order to provide discovery. That is different from an order to compel. But the case laws I discuss in my brief from other states and from federal courts indicate that an order to provide discovery can provide a basis for sanctions under Rule 37B. But as also noted, the order for sanctions is justified not only under that rule, but under 37D. Which allows the order for sanctions, and under the Putnam decision, which the Supreme Court ruled gives the court inherent authority to enforce its orders, regardless of the rules of discovery. So I think going back to Justice Reedman's question earlier, I think you need to look at the entire context of the case. Look at her failure to provide discovery, comply with the court rules over this entire 18-month period. All throughout this
don't
time.
Aren't you really looking at the period of time leading to the default judgment initially?
No.
Because that's when the sanction was imposed to enter a default judgment.
Yes, but that order was replaced then by the January 5, 2017 order. That then became the effective order that she subsequently challenged, and in fact, the one that she's challenging in this case, she hasn't even appealed from the final order that was entered on October 26th of 2017. What she is challenging is the January 5, 2017 order, at least in the appeal that she has filed in the brief that she submitted. So that's, apparently, that's the order that's on challenge before the court. So,
can I shift your focus just a little bit? I want to go to the prejudgment interest issue.
Yes.
So normally on a default judgment, we typically see them in situations where a party doesn't respond, doesn't file an answer. So a default judgment is entered, but the plaintiff still has to prove up on damages. Are the rules different when it's a sanction?
Yes.
And what's the authority for that?
Well, as you noted earlier, one of the sanctions that is permissible for failure to comply with discovery under 37D is a default judgment. Default judgment in this case, you look at the allegations of the amended complaint, which set out the request for judgment, including interest. And there was no challenge to that other than the answer. But otherwise, she did not challenge on the merits any of the allegations set forth in the amended
complaint. So if this had been a failure to file an answer, wouldn't the court have entered a default judgment on liability, and then the plaintiff still would have had to prove up on damages?
No, I think a default judgment, a judgment on liability as damages, as well as damages, would have been entered if there had been no answer filed, similar to what occurred here.
Plaintiff gets all the relief requested.
Right, right. That's what a default judgment is. I don't want to belabor it, but I think it's important to keep in mind, Holmeyer at no time challenged that by presenting what the court was requesting, that she provide discovery and what the court rules require. Instead, what she does is she serves discovery upon Sargent, which Sargent complied with and responded to. She wants to use the court process and the court rules of discovery to advance her own interests. But then she refuses to comply with the court rules and the court order when they're used, she perceives, against her. you can't have it both ways. And that's what the court's talking about in the Aetna casualty insurity case, where the court talks about that it won't tolerate a party's conduct designed to disrupt the orderly administration of justice. The court may not, parties may not disregard court orders until they choose. The case was brought about by appellant's lack of interest and concern in the lawsuit. Trial court was correct in refusing to set aside the default judgment. That's really what we have here. I submit that the district court did not, it can't be found that there was an abuse of discretion by the judgment entered by the district court. That's a final judgment that was properly entered in this case. At no time has Pohlmeier ever provided what she was being required to provide. And I'd ask the court to affirm the ruling and judgment of the district court, unless there are any further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Counsel is excused. Our next.
Oh, I'm sorry, we have a senior.
Our.